Hi, and welcome to episode 20 of the Digital Sociology Podcast with me, Chris Till. Today I'm talking to Jess Drakett, who is a colleague of mine from Leeds Beckett University, and she's in psychology, but she done some really interesting work, which is definitely relevant to this Digital Sociology Podcast. Some really great work on memes and how they relate to kind of internet culture in general, and humor and sexism and racism. And she connects that really well to other research which she's done, qualitative work around how that kind of meme internet culture connects with the kind of sexism we see in the tech industry, particularly in programming. So this is a really interesting chat I had with Jess, and I think you'll get a lot from it. As ever, I've put some more details on my blog and in the podcast episode description, and a few links to some of Jess's work, so you can read up on that and actually see some of the memes she's talking about. You can follow Jess on Twitter at Jessica Drakett. So that's JessicaDrakett. For more on the podcast in general, you can follow me at Chris H. Till on Twitter, and you can see my blog, thisisnotasociology.blog. And if you're listening to this, you're probably aware, but you can find the podcast on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you normally get podcasts. And always happy to hear any comments and ideas through the blog or through Twitter. So hopefully you'll enjoy this chat. Hi again. So today I'm talking to Jess Drakett, who is a senior lecturer in psychology at Leeds Beckett University, just a couple of floors away from me. So hi, Jess.
Hello, Chris.
Thanks for coming to talk to me.
Thank you for inviting me. It feels a little weird, but I'm totally on board with this.
Is this the first time on a podcast?
It is, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't even listen to that many
podcasts.
Do you not? No.
Okay. I'm really into podcasts, actually.
I should get into podcasts. This is something that I keep intending to do.
There's some really good ones. And I think one of the things I really like is that they can be really niche, like this one.
Yeah.
This is about digital sociology. You don't have to be, you know, it doesn't matter, like, how kind of focused kind of your audiences, I think. I'm trying to arrange to speak to you for a little while, and we kind of tried to, and then it didn't really happen,
we have kept missing for about a year or something,
but it doesn't matter because we're here now. But yeah, so we'll be talking today about Jess's work on two kind of related bits of your work, which both come together in your PhD, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Which you finished last year.
2017? Yeah, sounds right. Yeah. I handed in October 2016, then waited ages for my Viva in 2017,
Which was on the, it's kind of got two main elements to it, I think, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Which is analysis of memes, particularly image macros, and also kind of work, women working in tech.
Yeah, absolutely.
Broadly, would that be right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But it's kind of humour is one of the main aspects of your analysis.
Yeah, humour was the sort of driving force for me going into the PhD. I previously worked as a software developer, which is a weird route out of a psychology degree and then back into a PhD supervised by a team in psychology. And the thing that got me going was there was a lot of really overt sexism going on in technology, unsurprisingly. And it was often being framed as being humour or passed off as being just a joke. And I think I got to a point where I eventually snapped with that and just said, hey, no, something's wrong. This needs looking at. So that's how I ended up studying memes for a chunk of my life.
So we'll talk about the memes bit first, I think, because I think that makes sense kind of thematically. So you looked at a kind of variety of memes, but you were specifically looking... Probably most people listening to it probably have some understanding of what a meme is, but could you kind of define a meme and how you kind of see it?
Yeah, Limor Schiffman's work is probably the most appropriate when we're thinking about internet memes. the term meme's got a biological base. It's all about things evolving and changing.
Yeah.
And an idea or a song or an aspect. It's an element of culture that mutates and moves, and that's where you get this sort of viral and biological thing.
It's like
from
a gene.
Yeah, exactly meme, yeah. Like that. But Limor Schiffman's work sort of moves away from that sort of individual sort of idea of an individual unit towards groups of things that kind of shift and move and mutate and change. And I think that's probably a more useful way of thinking about it. It could be in relation to sort of digital memes. You could think about things like hashtags are a good example of a meme, something that takes off, spreads, mutates, changes, that kind of a thing. Or, you know, like these Daft Challenge videos, you know, like the Ice Bucket Challenge and all that kind of thing. That is a meme. It's an element of culture that gets reproduced and spread and changes and, it's messy definition.
It transmits, but yeah, exactly like... It kind of evolves because people add their own bits to it or adapt it or remix
it
or something. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all about that sort of participation, reuse and sort of resharing, which you're getting some really interesting things around copyright and attribution, which is going to be super fun with the EU.
But specifically your research, you looked at image macros.
Yes, I looked at image macros, which feel quite old to me now because when I first started looking at them, it was back in 2013 when I actually did my sampling and analysis, so that's a number of years ago now. And if I say memes now, people think about, you know, like the moth memes and the lamps and all that. Have you seen the moth? Oh, the moths are a delight. You'll love the moth. It's just a picture of a moth and it likes lamps and that's a thing.
Oh, because they're the light.
I would really struggle to analyse the moth for anything to do with like gender or like inequality. But that's where we're at now, which is kind of a nicer place to be, I guess. But the image macros, you'll most likely be familiar with an image with a text overlay, some sort of caption. It's usually in the white impact font with a little bit of a black border. They have a very specific look and feel to them, but they were what I was analysing. They're really easy to create as well.
So you kind of constructed a sample of these from some kind of like meme sites, really.
Yeah, we used the meme generator website, so it involved a lengthy sampling process to get it through ethics and just kind of justify what we were doing and actually have like a solid rationale. But it was about being really strategic with it. So we looked for the sites where you could not only create the memes, but we were interested in the ones where you could also share them. We also wanted them to have like a gallery where there was like a rating system that was really transparent and clear, like these are the top blah memes at this time. So we went in and we sampled the top however many from a number of different websites. And we'd chosen the websites based on all kinds of stuff like their Google PageRank and, you know, ways that we could figure out how popular a site was effectively. And that gave us, we ended up with 240, I think, off the top of my head, which is a lot.
And so, but you were looking at these for a particular... You were looking at them through a particular lens, so particularly looking at kind of gender and...
Yeah, looking for sort of representations or constructions of gender and technology, really. But it was also one of the first sort of studies looking at the content of memes. There were bits and pieces, I shouldn't say loads, there really wasn't that much. There were bits and pieces of work at the time looking at, you know, like the spread of memes and kind of mathematical networked sort of basis for study, but there wasn't anything really interrogating the content of them at the time anyway. So that's what we wanted to look at. So I kind of went in with a bit of a let's see what we find, but obviously I'd got particular aims around the thesis in relation to technology and feminism. So
yeah. Memes are, image macros in particular, but maybe memes in general, actually, are kind of inherently kind of, at least aimed at being humorous. Would you say, is humour an inherent part of them, would you say?
I think that's a core part of it, yeah. I think there's an entertainment value to them, whether or not that's humour or, it probably is humour, isn't it, let's be real. I think there's a humorous element for sure, but I think there's probably also a community-based element, and that's something that kind of came out in the analysis as well, was these creations of particular subcultures or communities online, and it's still something that I struggle with now, even like a couple of years after handing in my thesis, as to whether or not that's inherently a good thing or a bad thing, because I think there's certainly an exclusionary element to it. The memes we looked at, they weren't intended for everybody to understand, so there's an element of exclusivity to them, you know, like this is an in-joke, you can't understand this is our little secret language almost. But I wondered as well if there's also an inclusive element to that. So it's creating like a community with safe rules for somebody to participate in. Does that make sense? Mm. Kind of.
Yeah,
it's
but,
so messy.
But from reading your work, it did seem to me like, we'll get back to that humour in a second, but like, yeah. It did seem to me that there was quite a, it is quite rule bound.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah. There are rules. They are rules based units of culture. There's ways to do memes, but one of the things, one of the tactics for actually creating humour in some of them was subverting those rules.
Yeah.
So a lot of the image macros were stock characters, like familiar archetypes, and there would be a particular way of phrasing whatever the text overlay was. So like there's the picture of the guy in the beer advert, the most successful man in the world, where it's, I don't always do X, but when I do Y, kind of a setup. So people would sometimes use the wrong image to that, and then I don't always make a meme, but when I do, it's on the wrong template. So you've got these elements of, I don't know, like exploitable like parts of the memes that you can kind of mix and match for some of them. Like this, like the scumbag hat was a thing, so it was a like a Burberry hat.
So this is the scumbag Steve.
Scumbag Steve, yeah, exactly. So he's got like a checkered hat on, and people would take that hat and put it on something else to show that that thing was a scumbag in some way or another.
Yeah. So originally that is it's a photo of a guy. Was he in kind of like a rap group?
It was in a band or something. Yeah. It was like, see, the thing is, I had to figure out very quickly how to cite the Know Your Meme wiki, which is the most useful thing in the world if you ever want to study memes, because it charts sort of where things have come from. And it's you know, I never say to students, can you cite Wikipedia? But I've supervised a number of projects where I've said, you're going to have to cite this wiki because it explains things that just aren't being documented anywhere else. And I think it's really useful, sort of nice community-driven project. But yeah, there's a load of history on like his backstory and stuff.
That's
on
amazing.
It. It's absolutely
I need to look
fascinating.
At this. Yeah.
Some of them, like the other ones, the overly attached girlfriend.
Mm.
There's like a whole history for her, and you know the girl with the Goosebumps books, the Ermagerd girl.
Oh yes.
There's
yeah.
loads of history about all these people who have inadvertently often become.
So it is really,
it's
a really valuable archive. And,
it's really, really
yeah.
good. It's yeah. a really valuable resource, for sure.
But that's really, that's really interesting. So, the Scumbag Steve is this guy, he came to represent sort of just scumbagness.
Scumbaggery. Yeah.
Scumbaggery, yeah, exactly. But like you said, but even that gets broken down into elements. So it's even just
the
hat is enough.
The hat was enough. Like I remember one of them was... it was a picture of the teacher in the classroom, and they just put the scumbag hat on her, and it was like something about you drive 10 miles in the snow to come to class. Class is cancelled, like kind of a thing.
Yes.
I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But it snowed.
But it's a kind of a remarkably efficient.
Yeah.
Way of communicating a message within that group who understand the rules.
Yeah, absolutely. It's shorthand. Sometimes. I wonder if we're going to go back to like hieroglyphics and we're just going to entirely communicate in emoji and memes. But it's a similar kind of thing, yeah. It's shortcuts. They come to symbolise particular things, and people who know understand those things and can use them and can use them to communicate.
So obviously, anyone who knows anything about kind of humour, as in just in terms of having heard jokes or and have thought about them at all, knows that speaks to a lot of those things that humour very much works on shorthand and confounding expectations and twisting expectations.
Yeah.
I think. But I wonder if could you say, you said that there's a certain exclusionary element as well as that inclusionary element to it, which I think is a big part of your analysis.
Yeah.
Could you say a bit more about how that exclusion works and who's being excluded?
Yeah. So the main reason for me looking at memes was that they're a uniquely sort of technologically bound kind of humour, if that makes sense. It's a humour that exists in online space. It's meant for communicating in that space. And people who work in that space, often sort of developers and so on, are very familiar with these kind of like online cultures. So I actually got to a point, it's just come to me, in the second study where I was speaking to women in tech, where I was lucky enough to interview them, in their actual office, and they had printouts of memes on the walls, which we talked, I came across this concept of office folklore. So, like, in the olden days where photocopiers were a thing, I guess. Well, photocopies are still a thing.
Yeah,
but you know what I mean about, like, photocopied humour?
Yeah.
You get similar kind of things papered up. So I wondered if that was, if the memes were, like, a newer version of that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does, yeah, and especially because actually it's literally about reproduction as well.
Yeah, exactly. So these, you know, they've got their own office-based memes that had kind of come about in the office. Like, they had this picture of a pig, and I was like, oh, what's this? And they were like, oh, no, this is just the pig that is in our office, and it's like an internal meme almost. But they'd also got printouts of other familiar characters, just like, you know, on the end of bookcases and, you know, just above people's desks and that kind of thing. That was a really, like, nice validating moment for me, because it's something I'd struggled with articulating all the way through, was making sense to other people why it was related, why the study of memes and the study of, you know, organisational psychology and technology was remotely related. And that moment for me said, okay, these things aren't just excluding people online, they're potentially excluding people offline.
Yes.
So the way I'd thought about them being exclusionary online was, it was kind of coming back to that rules-based thing. If you don't know and you don't understand, that's one way of sort of, like, pushing people out. But there's also, like, the more, the kind of the less subtle ways. So, like, a lot of the memes were sexist, they were racist, you know, there's a lot of homophobia, like, bits and pieces of just absolute bigotry, like, coming through in them, which is pretty exclusionary, really. Yeah. So that was one of the things. And it was, because they were in that recognisable meme format, that was being positioned as humour. So, you know, it's easy to laugh off, it's easy to excuse it because it's just a joke. And does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I just wonder if we could just say a little bit about the actual kind of nature of the kind of joke. So it tended to be, you know, without getting too kind of graphic or anything, but
yeah.
they, as you said, tended to be sexist and racist. I think there's a particular kind of character to that, that it was a particularly techie version of that as well.
Yes, absolutely. And that was surprising because we didn't really target. So we thought about sampling tech memes, so like memes that have got a tech focus, and then we thought, no, let's go for general because it's you know it's understudied. We'll see what comes out, and yet there were still elements of sort of technological humour and joking in there. So there'd be loads of memes about. Like the Sean Bean, the one does not simply X into Mordor thing. It'd be like, Mum, one does not simply pause online games because, you know, women don't understand online games.
Especially mums.
Yeah, right, yeah. Especially mums. Yeah. Or like the picture of the oblivious, naive suburban mums. It's a woman in like a pink shirt and she's just smiling and looks like a perfectly normal woman. And the caption on that one was, my son says that there's always porn on the computer, it must be some sort of virus or something like that. And it's, you know, she's been positioned as being technologically naive, she's unfamiliar with porn, she's unfamiliar with viruses, all that kind of stuff. And there's some of the less explicit examples of that.
Yeah, no, but they're really good
at me to be.
No, that's enough. Yeah. But they give a really good idea, I think, of that.
Yeah.
It's often from, you know, from your analysis, it's often to do with games or to do with kind of knowledge
competence.
Of internet competence.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's
yeah.
Expertise and competence. So the ways in which men and women were shown to be using technology was really different as well. And that was kind of one of the first things we did when we started. We did a thematic analysis on this based on Brown and Clark. I should know how to pronounce that. Like, I know these people. Brown and Clark's work. But before we did that, like in the initial sort of familiarisation stage, we did a lot of like demographic coding on the memes. So we were coding for the characters. We were coding for, you know, what is this... content of this, really broadly speaking, is it a man, is it a woman, is it a Pokemon, is it this, that and the other. One of the first ideas for a paper title I had was like, one does not simply sample the internet. I'm coding the race of Pokemon. I was like, what race is a Pikachu? I don't know, which is a really weird question.
Well, apparently it's Ryan Reynolds,
so. Well, I know, Deadpool Pikachu. I'm really excited about this, it looks terrible.
Yeah.
It's very cute, though.
But who would have thought 4 years ago? I mean,
I know. But
when
I just
you were doing your project, yeah.
Well, it was the moment when I typed Pokemon into Word and it auto-corrected to give me the accent on the ear.
Okay,
I was like,
oh,
this is okay, I like this. But, we coded all these kind of demographic details first. So we had an idea of being able to sort of run queries against it and say, okay, show me everything that's got a man in it, show me everything that's got a woman in it, show me everything where a man and a woman's together, which was an interesting one. Mm-hmm. Every one of those with a man and a woman together had some sort of sexual connotation. Yay, mm-hmm. internet, thank you, great stuff. Ooh. But men, when they were shown to be using technology, were shown to be mastering it. They were doing things like, they were playing games, they were illegally downloading material, they were hacking, they were showing off, there was an element of like bravado and that kind of a thing. Mm. Whereas if women were shown in memes relating to technology, they were complaining that their diamond earrings had scratched their iPhone, or that nobody would play Farmville with them or something like that. There was a very different flavour of, engagement with technology coming through in those. It was really weird.
Yeah.
It's really weird. But it speaks volumes to the gendered nature of technology. So
yes, yeah, exactly.
Not that surprising.
No. Yeah. But really important, and I think that's why, as well as just being really interesting insights, it's really important that you've kind of done some of the cataloguing of that and making sense of it. And that's what, you know, it starts to bring that stuff out.
Surprisingly, when we'd actually sort of coded it at like a really sort of basic what is this about level, the majority of them were about school or college, that kind of thing. And we don't have demographics for who's creating these, because obviously, you know, we don't collect that information. I don't even think the websites collect that information. Mm-hmm. Ethically, we weren't sampling from places that required logins or anything like that. But that to us spoke to a particular type of person creating them, so we would best guess would be that this is younger, sort of like school, college age, teenage, likely boys creating a lot of these things, which again kind of makes sense given what we were looking at. So
yeah,
best guess.
no, I think so. Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of the best you can do in that kind of scenario, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it certainly speaks that, and I think you make the connection. I can't remember if it's in the paper of yours that I read, or if in your thesis, possibly both. It sort of connects with the kind of Revenge of the Nerds, American Pie kind of.
Yeah, it's a culture. Non-normative masculinity, but it's still one that reaps what Connell calls the patriarchal dividend. It's still paying off. It's different, but it still pays off.
Yeah, so it's kind of geeky culture, and also the kind the nerdy kind of, and possibly often. Sometimes the characters represented would be sort of like skinny, nerdy boys.
Skinny, nerdy boys, but they were shown to be like exceedingly sexually competent. Like,
yes.
Oh, what's his name? Oh, I should know this, but I've not looked at him in ages. The guy with the calculator surrounded by girls.
Oh, yeah, I remember this. Yeah,
Infamous. Oh, what's his name? Is it Priority Peter or something like that?
Yeah, I think this is right, yeah, because he's on his calculator.
He's got a calculator, but he's surrounded by women in bikinis.
Yeah.
And a lot of the captions are things like, sorry ladies, there's only one kind of tan I care about. And it's like, oh, it's a math joke, I get it, right?
Yeah.
But if you sort of dig deeper into that character, you find some really, really like explicitly sexual ones that are like, sorry ladies, no time for sex until I solve for X, and that kind of a thing. It's really interesting.
Yes, yeah, but certainly, yeah, it connects to that more mainstream kind of discourse. And that makes me think about, because it is consistent with a certain kind of broader media culture, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But also seems to be suggesting a certain kind of, through the kind of humour, challenging of at least a perceived PC, political correct kind of culture. Which actually has become since you've done your project, more of a kind of a central kind of political issue. Our kind of mainstream politicians now position themselves in that similar way of challenging PC culture.
Yeah, and I think it's really important how meme culture feeds into that
This is my question. Do you think that's how it's worked? Does it just chime with it, or is it feeding it?
I think it's a really big interrelated, ephemeral, messy blob. I mean, I don't want to talk about the alt-right, because it's not something that I want to engage with on any level, realistically, but some of the adoption of meme... I mean, there's articles around things like meme warfare, basically, and people using memes for various political agendas, which I completely get, because they're powerful. It's a nice, quick, easy way to share information and sort of get that into, I guess, like a cultural consciousness, if you like. And I think there's
there's value and there's risk to it. And I think there's a lot of potential for things to be exploited, if that makes sense. I think people are aware of the power of mimetic content.
Yes.
And that's a good thing and also a worrying thing.
Yeah. Well, the most obvious example is that it's Pepe the Frog, who's gone right from being just this kind of sort of weird little stoner kind of comic thing to literally
this is a like, symbol for Nazis, shorthand for Nazis.
Nazis and effectively one of Trump's mates.
Yeah. It's just
as much as a cartoon frog can be. which is bizarre. But yeah, I mean, I don't know, you've probably read Marwick and Lewis.
I think you sent me this.
Oh, this is what I sent you. Yeah,
I think it is, and I'm not. No.
But yeah, they've done some interesting stuff on this, looking at how. But also, it kind of, I think one of the ways it relates to what you're talking about is their opinion is that it is kind of it's a strategic push into the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely.
And because the kind of people that would be making the kind of memes that you're talking about as well is some of the people to what they're talking about in terms of they would know how to get, for instance, get their memes to like the front page of Reddit or 4chan or whatever, which we know has increasingly in the current kind of media kind of climate has a quite direct line to Reddit is like the fifth most visited website anyway, it's absolutely. Pretty mainstream, but really really mainstream as in on TV or in newspapers. So, yeah, I think that is, like you say, I mean, it can be used for all sorts of political purposes.
Yeah.
But again, I think what you're identifying here, it has a certain kind of hold over.
There's a power.
Or connection to,
it.
To yeah.
Yeah, there's a power. And I think, sort of steering away from politics, there's potential for people in marketing. Like, we see it all the time, people trying to create various viral marketing campaigns to varying degrees of success. Or, things that have inadvertently become viral, like Boaty McBoatface and all that kind of thing. I don't think anybody expected. Well, maybe they did because they put something on the internet. And maybe you should expect that these days, I don't know. But that kind of a thing. So maybe there's utility in it. It's just... what that gets used for.
Yeah.
Like anything, really.
Yeah.
Like, memes aren't inherently bad.
No.
Like, at all. In fact, they've got a lot of potential to be subversive and good, in my eyes. Like, think about things like the Me Too and the Time's Up hashtags. Mimetic culture.
Yeah,
really,
absolutely,
really interesting.
Yeah.
And, there's some really lovely academic work being done around that. Annadís Rudolfsdóttir in Iceland's been doing a lot of stuff around... sort of young feminists in Iceland's engagement with like the Free the Nipple campaign and stuff like that. Really, really interesting stuff. So there's potential for things to be nice.
Yes.
Maybe one day.
We'll move on to the kind of the work thing in a second. There's just a couple of points I wanted to kind of highlight. So you... someone who's not really an expert in this area at all, but... I think there's something to me that's slightly kind of persuasive about, or kind of seductive about memes, which is actually the quite amateurishness of them. And I just wonder if you had anything to say about this sort of, because my assumption is the people making these, many of them will have quite sophisticated technical abilities, I would guess.
Potentially.
Or at least some. Yeah. I mean, they could make them look a lot nicer than they are, was my kind of book, but they don't want to.
No. So the way a lot of the macros are generated is straightforward. Like, you just go on a website, choose the background image, and type some stuff. Like, you need no particular competence to make them at all. You need particular technical competence to be able to make the sites that make that.
Yes.
So there's a layer of, I guess, interesting questions to be raised around that. Mm. So who facilitates the making of memes, I guess? Which isn't actually something I never thought about until this moment in time. So that's kind of... That's a new one for me to think about.
Yeah,
thanks, Chris.
New project,
Oh, God. I thought I was done with memes. But for the most part, it's relatively straightforward to just go online and make an image macro.
Right.
Whether or not that gets a lot of reach and gets shared a lot is another question, I guess. Depends on... what it is, where you're sharing it, how the internet's feeling that day, I guess. But back on the sort of like the amateurish nature of it, there's something really interesting to be said around sort of viral content and YouTube. So Jean Burgess has done work around participatory, like, online culture. And there's I'm sure one of the factors around whether or not a video sort of does well is that kind of authenticity. Mm. So does it feel like an authentic, like, underproduced kind of thing? Does that make sense?
Yeah,
like,
definitely,
there's a rawness to it, I think, that people relate to. And I'm sure that that's why people like, like beauty bloggers and that kind of thing. It's expertise and it's competence, but it's being positioned in a very sort of authentic way, not in a marketed way.
Yeah.
Until, you know, a certain level of success is reached, and then I guess it does become marketed and
you
get Zoella selling 50 quid advent calendars or whatever. Maybe that's a little bit different
to
somebody sitting in their bedroom and teaching you how to blend eyeshadow, which is arguably more real.
But there's that style to them, isn't there? That, of like the kind of like those really like hard edit cuts where they kind of that's still, when you get to the point of you've got 100 million followers or whatever they've got, that's deliberate, you know, because that could be slicker than it is.
Yeah, somebody's got the money and time to make that better than it is, but they aren't.
Yeah, so that is a choice.
So
I think you're right. It's something to do with that kind of authenticity.
I think it is. I think it's an authenticity thing. And I think that's something that is sort of valued in a lot of online cultures or communities, is this idea of belonging and authenticity, and it feeds back around to that idea of, you know, like fake nerd girls, oh, they aren't really into video games, they're doing it to attract a man, and all this kind of,
oh, the kind of people going to kind of cosplay things,
exactly the same kind of thing. Oh, they're not really into this character, and it's like, well, how do you know that?
Yes,
it's an authenticity thing, it's a form of gatekeeping, and that is exactly what I found in the discussions around workplaces and tech.
So yes, absolutely. Yeah,
people were acting as gatekeepers to a particular kind of work in various ways.
And so, good transition. Again,
accidental.
So you kind of saw when you went and did some research, so you did kind of interviews.
It was a right mess. It was brilliant. Yeah.
Mostly dyadic interviews.
Couple of those. Okay. It was meant to be 6 focus groups, each with 6 participants. Lovely design, beautiful. You run all these nice focus groups. But it ended up being like a big pile of focus groups and some one-on-one interviews and some dyadic interviews, just because I had a lot of trouble recruiting people.
Yeah.
And that was largely due to the fact that I was looking at, we wanted to speak to women who were studying for careers in tech, women who were working in tech, women who'd left careers in tech. And obviously women who've left careers in tech don't all go to the same place. So they were quite hard to recruit. And, you know, if they've left, they have left for a reason a lot of the time and don't necessarily want to discuss that. And that's something that I ran into. I thought it'd be easier to recruit students, but they were actually really difficult to recruit, which was sad. I was met with a lot of, not really resistance, just unhelpfulness from various departments, which was not necessarily here, but like other sort of university departments that I approached to try and recruit, which was sad. I don't know if it's just because there aren't that many women on these kinds of courses.
But yes.
Yeah, it was.
But you would think that they would be interested in knowing why,
you know,
there aren't more.
You know, speak, it's free feedback from your students, so somebody else is going to run it. So so the methods were a total mess, but it was nice. It gave me a lot of stuff to write about and reflect on. But I ran a bunch of interviews, basically, with women at various stages of tech careers over that kind of entry through exit trajectory. Mm. So, yeah.
And again, you were particularly interested in the kind of cultures and around how humour's used. And you kind of, I suppose, in my really crude rendering of this, you saw a connection between that kind of meme culture and the workplace culture, the same kind of exclusionary practices.
Yeah, so the first halves of the interviews were sort of talking about work, how they got into tech, the kind of like the tech life stories almost, what they did, what they loved about it, what they maybe didn't love about it. And the second half, I actually presented them the results from the memes analysis. It was very kind of raw at that point. I'd not even really written it up, to be honest. I told my supervisors I murdered me. I'm still scared of them. But I kind of presented where I was at with that and just kind of asked for their feedback and just kind of said, so here's what I think I found. What do you think? And, you know, a lot of them were like, oh, my God, yeah, I know these characters. This is really funny. Oh, hang on, wait, when I look at it in this way, it's not necessarily that funny. I had some quite hostile participants who were like, this is pointless. I don't understand why you're doing it. And I was like, okay, I'm sorry. I'm fine, just been doing this for like 2 years. Okay, it's fine. So that was a little weird. But like I said earlier, when I got to see sort of printed out memes in the wild, or people were saying, oh yeah, I sent this one to my colleagues like last week, or, you know, we use GIFs to communicate in like local chat channels and that kind of thing. It kind of validated what I was doing and why I was doing it, because I knew that this media was a big part of their sort of tech work experience as well as their outside tech life experience. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's part of the communication process in the way that emails are in all workplaces. Absolutely. And that kind of thing. Yeah.
I think if we ever move to using like Microsoft Teams, we'll probably see more use of GIFs and memes between us, but it's just not the way we work.
No, yeah. I mean, I've already seen more kind of emojis, I think, in the last couple of years.
I've started to see more sort of filtering through. I've also had some worrying emails from students where it's clear that they're typing an email on their phone and they just end it with a kiss, and I'm like, oh, no, please.
Yes,
no.
Sent
from my iPhone.
The sent from my iPhone thing kind of almost makes you feel a bit better.
It's like, okay, they are thinking, they think this is a text message.
But I think that's something, actually, that's another kind of issue. I think with students, they don't necessarily see those distinctions necessarily as maybe we might do.
Yeah, because they don't remember the time when you had a dial-up modem.
Or anything other than just a phone. Some of the stories you kind of drew on from the interviews were really, they were already interesting. Some were quite kind of moving, really, I think. And the kind of, I think in some cases where people have maybe kind of sort of internalised some of the kind of sexist kind of cultures as well. So could you talk a bit about how you saw those kind of manifesting in that sense? So how did people, what kind of exclusionary kind of ideas or practices did people experience?
There was an uncritical subscription to a lot of problematic discourse, but I think that some of that is in part a survival strategy for working in quite troubling environments, if that makes sense. So there's a lot of, oh yeah, this is really funny, oh actually maybe it's not that funny, or you know, this is talking about a particular kind of oppression, but I don't experience that at all because I'm a strong, empowered woman and I don't need anybody's help. But all that kind of
So that's kind of manifestation of the kind of the sort of like neoliberal feminism kind of the kind of mentioned
it's
the
subscription to that
Sheryl Sandberg kind of
lean in and all that kind of thing, stuff. Yeah. It's a subscription to a particular discourse that's manifest right across our culture that. It's meritocratic, which it is, and that, you know, individual strength and capability is amazing, and you can have anything you want, and you can do anything you want, and there's no issues around inequality, because, you know, feminism's won, and we're beyond a point of doing feminism, and, you know, it was really interesting. Humour, in terms of the workplace, it wasn't really explicitly discussed as such. It was those kind of, like I say, when I realised that these things were just a common way of communicating or being shared in offices and that kind of thing, these were the kind of points of connection in between the sort of two studies. Mm-hmm. And also seeing the sort of like the assumptions around how women use technology from the memes, you know, like they're less capable, that they use it in a certain way, seeing that mapping across in terms of women feeling the need to constantly defend their competence and prove themselves to be experts and kind of demonstrate that they are allowed to be there, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's where we started to get these like sort of little points of, you know, connection between the two studies.
And so was that justification of them being legitimate in that scenario, was that at all manifest in terms of positioning themselves against those other types who aren't allowed to be here?
Absolutely. There was a lot of sort of subscription to a I'm not like other women kind of a discourse for some of them. You know, they were very keen to position themselves, you know, as being different to, I don't know, women that worked in HR or something like that, constructing a very particular type of organisational femininity and what that kind of person does. And I don't want any of this to sound disrespectful, because I understand why this sort of strategy happens. And there's a particular example where somebody's talking about how they got into technology, and they're saying about how they'd learned to make websites when they were about sort of 12, 13, and they'd done it by going and looking at other people's source code behind their websites to try and figure out what certain things did, and that they'd always laugh when they saw that they'd use like an editor like Front Page or something, like going back a number of years, but they'd used an editor and not written the code themselves by hand. So it was like, ha, you're not even coding by hand, I'm much better than you. And it was this kind of, it was almost mirroring this like elite technologically competent thing we'd seen in the memes. And it sounds awful, but I understand why, and this is something I've got an entire reflexivity chapter where I stared into the abyss that is my soul and realised that I too had a really similar tendency to position myself in similar ways. Because like I think a lot of the sort of women I spoke to were of a similar age to me, a little bit older, a little bit younger. We'd got very similar entry routes into technology. We'd not had a linear path. Like I did a psychology undergrad degree, and I kind of fell into programming. Elizabeth Kellen talks about the serendipitous nature of women falling into things. You know, it's not a direct path. And every time I say that, I'm really like, oh my God.
I've not heard about that before, but that makes, I've heard people say that a lot.
It's not a deliberate sort of entry route. It's not something that's, you know, explicitly thought about. And it's something I really struggle with, because I kind of went, oh shit, I'm an awful person. This is exactly what I do. You know, I'd be like, oh, no, can't even code, can't even do this. Yeah. And then it's like, oh no, you're trying to demonstrate your expertise and competence in a scenario that's constantly demanding.
It's a way of dealing. It's a way of dealing with those structural inequalities and exclusions. Yeah.
But, and it's that's why I mean so sort of careful, I think, and sort of cautious with language, because I understand the subscription to arguably problematic discourses that reproduce those kinds of ideas in technology, and it's not straightforward, and it's not going to be straightforward to dismantle like at all. So. Yeah, does that kind of answer that question?
Yeah, no, incredibly well, yeah, incredibly well. Do you think that, to what extent do you think that sort of challenging these kind of problematic forms of humour that you've identified is needed to play a role in that, in making these spaces less exclusionary? Yeah.
I think it's just important to just call people out on their bullshit, to be honest. Yeah. And that's, there's a big chunk of reflexivity around that. I talk about how when I first started my thesis, I was, you know, I used to play Guild Wars 2 a lot and I loved it. It was my favourite MMO. And I used to see a lot of terrible stuff in the map chat, people sharing like really sexist or racist stuff. And as online communities go, Guild Wars 2 community is pretty reasonable. So it wasn't like as bad as others that I've seen. But, I would kind of quietly tolerate it, and I think as I got further and further through my project, I was like, nope, I'm going to start a fight, even if it means my character's going to die, I don't care, let's start a fight with somebody on the internet. So I think just sort of challenging stuff when you see it and calling stuff out and knowing that there are other people that think this is bullshit as well, and they've got your back. So. Yeah.
And I suppose the insidious kind of nature of this is the use of the of humour in it.
Yeah, because it's
because that's a way of deflecting that kind of any critique.
It's used to excuse stuff, it's used to sanitise stuff, you know, we can't possibly be mad because it's just a joke. And it's like, well, it's not just a joke. Like, have you seen the Randy's Burger thing in Sheffield the other week?
I did, yes.
Oh my goodness.
So this was, like, really briefly for anyone who's not heard of this, this is a kind of like a burger place in Sheffield, and they released a menu of burgers which were basically just named after sexual abusers or sexual abuse. So there was like the Weinstein burger.
There was like a bunch of things that were like named after various like porn scenarios and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Just really gross. Like, what? It's a burger. It doesn't need to be named after sexual violence. What is wrong with you? Really. And the thing that really got me with that was the fact that I had a look at their Twitter, because I'm convinced I want to do some research on this and like the sort of discussion that sort of followed it. I had a quick look at their Twitter, and they were explicitly messaging the Sheffield Uni and Sheffield Hallam Uni sports societies and being like, hey, we've got special offers for sports societies, and you've got a menu full of rape jokes. Yeah, you know exactly what you are doing.
They do,
It's so creepy and gross, and no.
Yes. no, absolutely, yeah. And I think you're right, and it's... I think you used a quote in your thesis, I think it's from Laurie Penny, where she said this point about that you're supposed to just take these jokes, but...
Like a punch.
You take them like a punch.
In the way that one's meant to take a punch.
Yeah. And that was really good. Because, and that really gets at that point that they are bruising.
Yeah.
And damaging and this kind of thing. Yeah, and these things are kind of difficult to kind of call, and I think the point is that it needs to be everyone calling out. You know, it's not just for women to call people out on this. It's for men as well, because as you mentioned, that really great notion of the patriarchal dividend before, that
pays off.
Yeah, well, this is it, because even men who aren't necessarily directly engaging in this stuff, they're kind of still complicit in it by just kind of letting it happen or whatever. And I think that's really important, and I think your work helps to kind of give a critical framework to kind of to see it the way that it needs to be seen.
That makes me feel good today.
I think that's right. It really had a big impact on me, actually, I think, just because I haven't really kind of grown up around kind of internet and kind of techie culture, but it still just connects to a broader, you know, general kind of masculine culture that I have kind of grown up in and existed more in when I was kind of, you know, a teenager and this kind of thing. But it's still very much there, and a lot of those elements still spoke to that kind of experience and things I've kind of struggled with around that, you know, growing up and even to some extent in adulthood as well.
Yeah.
And they are kind of difficult issues. It's more difficult for people who aren't kind of straight white men, but they're still you know, it's kind of still kind of tricky. But I think again, it helps to kind of get a language of a way of looking at that.
Yeah, being able to question it, I think that's one of the really interesting things, because I'm in psychology, but I wouldn't necessarily describe myself as a psychologist a lot of the time. I take much more of a feminist critical approach to my work. You know, I'm not about chopping rats up and sticking wires on people. That's not at all what I'm into. I often say that my work sort of straddles sociology and media and cultural studies and elements of psychology and, you know, technology as well. It's really interdisciplinary. But psychological approaches to humour have tended to focus on this idea that humour is this amazing thing. It's great for well-being. We can't possibly question it. And if we start to think, oh, well, we can't question it, then we lose out on being able to challenge some of these problematic uses, where it is being used to sanitise really problematic sentiments or, you know, particular viewpoints. And it's important to be able to ask questions. And if you say something's, you know, wholesale, it's perfect, it's lovely and positive, everybody needs to have a good laugh, it's great for well-being. Well, fair enough, it might be in some cases, but, you know, who's... We need to interrogate power in relation to humour as well. You know, who is the butt of the joke? You know, like, which direction is power operating in? I think that's something that's really...
Punching down, yeah.
It's really important to be able to question that, I think.
Yeah, and I think Bantz is never just Bantz.
No, oh, God, no.
Nope. I hate Bantz. But,
I hate Bantz. Yeah. Like, just no.
And so should we? I think we'll end there. It's been great to talk to you. I don't want to kind of keep you any longer, but no, it's been really fun. And I look forward to seeing where your research goes next, whether that's into sexist burgers or somewhere else.
Maybe sexist burgers. Who knows? Thanks, Chris.
Bye.